chasm between Mr. McConnell's political imperatives and those of Mr. McCarthy, who must win the House in races where loyalty to Donald Trump has become a prerequisite. In a nod to that reality, he made the trip to Palm Beach, Florida, and has remained silent about Marjorie Taylor Greene. Senator John Thune of South Dakota, the number two Republican in the Senate, backed Mitch McConnell on Tuesday, telling CNN that House Republicans would have to decide who they want to be. Do they want to be the party of limited government and fiscal responsibility, free markets, peace through strength and pro-life? Or do they want to be the party of conspiracy theories and QAnon, said Mr. Thune, who served in the House for 6 years. I think that is the decision they've got to face. Senate Republicans are also facing that choice as they look to Donald Trump's impeachment trial and the decision of whether to convict him on a bipartisan charge of incitement of insurrection. All but five of them, including Mitch McConnell, voted last week to dismiss the trial as unconstitutional, a reflection of how reluctant they still are to cross the former president. Still, a phalanx of Republican senators followed Mitch McConnell's lead on Tuesday, inserting themselves into the House turmoil to urge leaders there to reject Marjorie Taylor Greene. I think we should have nothing to do with Marjorie Taylor Greene and think we should repudiate the things that she said and move away from her, Senator Mitt Romney of Utah said. I think our long history as a party has shown that it's important for us to separate ourselves from the people that are in the wacky weeds. And if we don't, then our opposition tries to brand us with their image and their point of view. Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican of Louisiana, told CBS that he agreed with Mitch McConnell entirely, saying, "We have to move beyond what someone thinks may be true because it is on the internet." Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, took to Twitter to express his support for Liz Cheney, calling her one of the strongest and most valuable conservative voices in the Republican Party. But Lindsey Graham, who was one of Donald Trump's most loyal allies on Capitol Hill, later told reporters that he was not ready to repudiate Marjorie Taylor Greene, saying he needed to hear more about whether the reports about her comments were accurate and whether she still believed in what she had said. Republican leaders have been mum in recent weeks as they have mulled how to deal with Liz Cheney, the daughter of former U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, who was elected to her first term in November. Donald Trump is still popular with a majority of their members, who voted to support his bid to overturn his election defeat. Even as some of them privately harbor concerns about his influence on the party, Republicans are keenly aware that the smoothest path to victory in many House districts is by appealing to base voters who revere him. Underscoring the balancing act, Representative Andy Biggs, Republican of Arizona and the chairman of the Hard Right Freedom Caucus, issued a warning on Tuesday in response to a plan by House Democrats to strip Marjorie Taylor Greene of her committee assignments. The Democrats' move to strip Congresswoman Greene of her committee assignments for thoughts and opinions she shared as a private citizen before coming to the U.S. House is unprecedented and unconstitutional, Andy Biggs said. All self-righteous Republicans, beware. If this can happen to Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, it can happen to any one of us. Mr. McCarthy has yet to personally comment on the extensive stream of racist and conspiracy-laden social media posts made by Marjorie Taylor Greene before she came to Congress. A spokesman said last week that posts in which she endorsed killing Democratic lawmakers were deeply disturbing, and that the leader planned to address them in a conversation with Ms. Greene this week. Mr. McCarthy has taken a marginally less reluctant tone on calls for Ms. Cheney to resign from leadership, telling reporters that he supported her but felt it would be appropriate for the conference to discuss the manner in which she announced her support for impeachment. Leader McCarthy is in a very tough position, an unenviable position, said Carlos Curbelo, a Republican former congressman from Florida. But it's pretty obvious that he's trying to find a balance between the long-term interests of the Republican Party and his own short-term political interests and those of the members who are serving today. Mr. Curbelo said that if there were a secret ballot vote to expel Marjorie Taylor Greene from the conference, she would overwhelmingly lose. But if the vote were public, lawmakers would vote for her to remain in the conference. Members know what doing the right thing means, but ultimately a lot of them fear Donald Trump and his base, and that's why they're stuck in his vicious cycle, Mr. Curbelo said. Members will say, a lot of the voters in my district believe these conspiracy theories, and a lot of the reason they do is because these members won't level with them. Ms. Greene announced over the weekend that she had spoken with Donald Trump and received his support in what amounted to a veiled threat to Republicans who might be considering taking action against her. To drive home her point, she said on Monday, 1st of February, that she planned to meet with the former president at Mar-a-Lago, his private club in Florida, soon. Mr. McCarthy also traveled there last week in an effort to mend a rift with Donald Trump that was caused by the leader's assertion that the former president bore some responsibility for the attack on the Capitol building on 6th of January. Mitch McConnell, in contrast, has repeatedly signaled to his party that he is ready to cut Donald Trump loose, making clear to associates after the Capitol attack that he viewed the former president's actions around the riot as impeachable, and blaming him in a speech from the Senate floor for provoking the mob. He's sending up an urgent warning that we can't be a national governing party, we can't be a majority party, we can't even be competitive if we're going to be a party of Jewish space lasers, and that 9/11 didn't happen, and all the conspiracy theories that Marjorie Taylor Greene has endorsed, Scott Jennings, a former top aide to Mitch McConnell, said on CNN. Scott Jennings said that warning extended to attempts to force Liz Cheney out of her leadership role. If what comes out of this entire January 6th ordeal is that Liz Cheney is the only person who winds up punished, he said, it would be an absolute travesty.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Talk about the laws of copyright according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahth al-Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahth al-Kharij, he started Bahth al-Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Jawid, we are talking about the laws regarding copyright according to Ayatollah Khomeini. You know, we have such cases that the compiler sometimes or the contributor to an intellectual property is dead. So due to death or travel or something quite unexpected and the like, who should one turn to for permission to reproduce a work? And who should the money be paid to? I know this from experience because I've been involved in several cases such as that. You know, for example, patent offices, normally due to the death or even due to the lapse of time.
Yes.
When the time passes by, they have this stipulation that the copyright for an invention, for example, expires after 20 years.
Good.
For you know, similar cases in regard to books, sometimes it is extended to 50 years. This time period, in fact, prolongs to a period of 50 years. When the author, the original author, is dead, then the book is going out of the copyright laws. So what does, in fact, Ayatollah Khomeini say about this?
Well, you said that the compiler or maybe the original writer could be on a journey or maybe he could be dead. Okay?
Yes.
If he's on a journey, because they death and travel, they are two different issues, and of course they cannot be
treated the same.
Treated in the same way.
Yes.
If someone is on a journey, especially in the at this time, which is the age and time of internet, and of course telecommunication, it's very easy to contact him and find him or locate him, and then get his permission. If there are other scenarios, like if someone is in jail, he can still be reached and contacted, and his permission can be sought. And of course, in modern time, it's when a writer writes, he usually gives his book file to a publishing institute, and he tells the gives the necessary permission. That is something. Okay. Now, in the case of death, assuming that he has not left anything to indicate that he has given any permission, and he has not communicated his message or his will to the publishing institute, then of course Ayatollah Khomeini, may Allah grant him long life, says that the permission has to be sought from his legal guardian, okay, or his heir, okay. He has brothers and sisters. He has got maybe his father is alive,
yes,
and maybe the closest relative. The heirs could be his uncles even, okay. you could contact his inheritors, and these are the people who can give permission or can give even deny permission on his behalf. So if they give permission, there's no objection. You can go ahead and, of course, reproduce or reprint the material.
I see. La ilaha illallah,
Allahu Akbar. The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Is it also permissible to reprint books without permission of their authors or their owners, especially with the existence of the phrase, as you can see a lot at the beginning of some books, all rights reserved? So if there is this phrase, all rights reserved, yes, is it still possible or permissible to reproduce a part of the book without the permission of the author?
As I said, Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei exercised precaution.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike Ayatollah Sistani, who says, of course, you can produce it, reprint it for your own personal use, you cannot sell it, you cannot distribute it, Ayatollah Khamenei says that it's a matter of caution or a matter of ihtiyat, that the rights of both the author and the publisher must be actually respected through obtaining their permission to reprint the material. So the right could be that of the publisher, or it could be that of the author. So in either case, their permission has to be obtained for reprinting the material. Of course, in cases that there is a rule, it should be observed. It should be observed in the case of in the case when there is, for example, written on the book, all rights protected, all rights reserved. So in this case, of course, one cannot go ahead, even if he does not find the author or the publisher, he cannot go ahead and print it in his without getting his permission. His permission has to be, the permission has to be obtained in such cases, either from the publisher by looking for him, locating him, or by from the original owners. So I said, as I said, Ayatollah Khamenei exercises precaution, and this precaution is a mandatory precaution. It's not something simple. It's not something to be ignored. The as long as a person is acting upon the precaution, he has to act. But if he moves to the next mujtahid to follow the next mujtahid, the next most learned mujtahid, then that's something else.
Mm-hmm. You know, Sheikh Javid, sometimes video cassettes or tapes and cassettes containing Quranic recitation and religious songs bear or hold the phrase recording rights reserved. All right.
Yes.
What is the religious law about this, to make copies of such cassettes or videotapes and give them to people who are interested in having them?
Yes. A lot of people think that since these cassettes are religious, okay, in
yes.
nature.
Yes.
So religious cassettes do not require any kind of permission. We can use them, we can listen to them without even ignoring the consideration of the original author. That's not the case. Even if a lecture,
yes.
lecture,
mm-hmm.
not a religious song, actually is made public and it's protected actually copyrighted and protected under the law, then as a measure of precaution, one should obtain the permission of the original publisher to make copies of the cassette. So again, I should say that Grand Ayatollah Khamenei indeed exercises precaution, and precaution means here that we should consult the publisher, or we should find the original producer, the person who has published or released that cassette or that song, religious song, to get his permission. Otherwise, we cannot reproduce and publish it, or even sell it. Selling something which belongs to someone else is not allowed. It is considered to be unauthorized transaction.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
the United Kingdom handed over control of Hong Kong back to the Chinese in July 1997. Various agreements were made in order for the island to maintain some kind of autonomy. However, over two decades later, Hong Kong is very much an integral part of China, and hence why China sees all affairs surrounding the island as sovereign business. Yet, following the implementation of the National Security Law, preventing a variety of crimes, including secession, subversion, terrorism and collusion, the UK promised to issue eligible Hong Kong residents citizenship to Britain, something that Prime Minister Boris Johnson has recently reiterated he will honour. The ability for Hong Kong residents to apply for the special visa may see hundreds of thousands of people apply to travel, live and settle in the UK, and has seen immigration offices in Hong Kong see a surge in demand for applications as the process begins to fall into place. However, China has taken offence to the offer by the British, with the Chinese Foreign Affairs spokesman Zhao Linjian stating that the move grossly interferes with Chinese internal affairs. He further stated that China will no longer recognise BNO passports as valid travel documents. Furthermore, Chinese authorities are baffled as to why residents would want to leave Hong Kong and head to the UK, claiming that once they arrive there, they'll be considered as second-class citizens, something that China may very well have a point on when one considers the levels of discrimination and racism against foreigners in Britain, meaning that new arrivals could fast become targets of British anti-hospitality, something that the Brits have a long and tarnished record of. What now remains to be seen is just when and how so many new residents will make their way over to the UK, in particular as Britain faces the toughest ever travel measures amongst the peak of the COVID-19 virus, which has already killed in excess of 100,000 British people already. As Britain comes to the stark realisation that leaving the EU may have caused more problems than benefits, it seems that one thing that was not calculated was a sudden resentment towards Europeans, in particular Eastern Europeans, who made up a significant percentage of the low-skilled workforce in Britain, meaning that many EU citizens felt they were no longer welcome in the country.
During my previous 6 years in the UK, I was contributing to the economy here. I cherished Britishness. I worked in companies such as Barclays and subsequently British Airways, and most of my working life has been concentrated on public sector. And then one snap decision destroyed it all, and suddenly I felt, I actually do not belong here. I am no longer welcome.
It's hence why Britain needed to find an alternative source of labour to fill the void as Europeans leave the UK and head back to their home countries in the European Union. And hence why Boris Johnson, when asked what he would do about the Hong Kong situation, saw an opportunity waiting to be developed. Boris Johnson is no doubt using the opportunity for BNO status holders in Hong Kong to find a way into the UK, and hence why suddenly, unlike European citizens who no longer feel welcome, he claims he's proud to allow the people of Hong Kong to live and work in Britain. After all, his economy depends on having a wide range of workforces. So bad is the labour drain in Britain that the number of Europeans having left the country has seen EU citizens' levels in Britain at the lowest for over 5 years, meaning that more people are leaving Britain than actually entering the country. And with Brexit being such a dividing topic in Britain, the government have gone one step further by secretly adding EU nations to the so-called voluntary return scheme, which actually pays EU citizens to get out of Britain, covering their flight costs and also providing £2,000 in a cash envelope in the process, showing just how deep Britain's discrimination and hatred of the EU really is. What now remains to be seen is whether the people of Hong Kong are genuinely willing to fall into the trap that their Eastern European predecessors managed to escape from in Britain, and whether actually leaving Hong Kong and truly becoming second-class citizens is better than living in their own country.
The coronavirus pandemic battered the global economy like nothing else has done for decades. Prolonged nationwide lockdowns in some countries and mismanagement of the crisis in others have all contributed to 2020 becoming one of the gloomiest years for the global economy. It's not surprising to learn, according to a new report from the International Labour Organization, that workers around the world have lost $3.7 trillion since the pandemic began. Globally, 8.8% of working hours were lost, and 114 million people experienced employment loss, what the report called an unprecedented level. What's shocking is another report that made headlines. Billionaires around the world who initially suffered massive losses like everyone else have seen their wealth increase by $3.9 trillion as the entire globe has been grappling with the impacts of the deadly respiratory disease. That figure, according to the Oxfam report, is enough to vaccinate every single person on Earth against the coronavirus and help them stay out of poverty.
It's a new normal, but I don't think it's a sustainable new normal. So the level of increase in wealth is enormous. And it's already coming not out of the market system now, which is what caused the inequality before the financial crisis. It's now coming out of the impact of government policy. And this is really the ineffectiveness of government policy led by mainstream economists who have no idea of the role of inequality really in society. Most of their models talk about a representative agent where they lump together income from wages and income from profits as if we both receive them equally. So that level of naivety lies behind policies that believe we can revive the economies by boosting the wealth of the wealthy.
In the meantime, the workers may have to wait for a decade to be able to recover the losses they sustained. The report also estimates between 200 million to 500 million people may have fallen into poverty during 2020. Oxfam has said in its report that the world's billionaires' collective net worth is now standing at nearly $12 trillion, equivalent to what G20 countries have spent in response to the pandemic. The most vulnerable workers have faced some of the biggest job losses throughout the pandemic's recovery, and that K-shaped trajectory may continue.
This is Ben Bernanke, who's on record as saying this, thought one way to revive the economy was to increase the value of shares and cause what he calls a wealth effect to encourage more spending and stimulate the economy. And I summarise that as trying to make the economy better by making the wealthy wealthier, because only a tiny fraction of the population owns shares, and that boosted their wealth without touching what happened with the remainder. Now, when COVID has struck, a very similar process is afoot. Central banks are buying bonds again, giving the financial sector large amounts of cash, which they then use to buy shares, which drives up share prices. And that's what's causing what's called the K-shaped recovery. Asset markets, particularly share markets, are skyrocketing, while at the same time, because workers can't go to work due to lockdowns and the impact of COVID, the income of workers is falling.
The International Labour Organization said there were some encouraging signs of recovery at the start of 2021, with the COVID-19 vaccine gradually being deployed around the world. However, it's still estimated the continuing economic fallout would lead to a 3% loss of working hours globally in 2021, compared with the end of 2019, equivalent to 19 million full-time jobs. In a pessimistic scenario, which assumes slow progress on vaccination, working hours would fall by 4.6% this year, while in an optimistic path, the world economy would still lose 1.3% of working hours. The outcome would depend on how well the pandemic was brought under control and by how much consumer and business confidence recovered. A slow vaccine rollout and uneven distribution could also impact the speed at which the global economy recovers. This has led the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to downgrade their respective outlooks. It seems that the only way out of the current economic situation for the governments around the world is aiming for a targeted recovery that prioritizes employment and would provide support for hard-hit workers and sectors.
Bangladesh's government sent another group of Rohingya Muslim refugees to a remote and deserted island in the Bay of Bengal. More than 1,400 refugees set sail for the island of Basanchar. It was the fourth group sent to the island, and the Bangladeshi government plans to eventually move 100,000 Rohingya to the remote island. Bangladesh also aims to decongest refugee camps in Cox's Bazar, which shelters approximately 1 million Rohingya. The relocations began in December and have been criticized by human rights groups who say that many of the refugees are being forced to move against their will. The government of Bangladesh says the relocation is voluntary, but many refugees have talked about the move as being coerced. Rights organizations say the Bangladeshi government used cash incentives as well as intimidation tactics to force Rohingya to accept the relocation offer. Bangladeshi authorities say the relocation is essential to ensure better living conditions for the refugees and to improve the camps in Cox's Bazar.
As a matter of fact, Bangladesh and India were among the countries which from the beginning opposed the incoming of these refugees. As a matter of fact, they identified them as terrorists and they did not give them what their rights under international law and under the humanitarian law as refugees. And we've seen that it's continuing. They see the Rohingya Muslims as a problem rather than sort of oppressed people that they need to be supported at this hour of need.
The refugee camp became overcrowded from August 2017 when Rohingya Muslims began fleeing their homes in Rakhine State following waves of attacks by Myanmar's army and Buddhist mobs. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims were violently uprooted in the months that followed, driven by a brutal military crackdown that killed thousands of them. What happened in August 2017 was so horrific that the UN called it genocide and a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Those who survived the brutal killings sought refuge in Bangladesh and neighboring countries, hoping for a day to return home. But for now, it seems that thousands of them have to go on yet another perilous journey. The Rohingya are the world's most persecuted ethnic minority, haunted by the past and denied a future. A citizenship law in 1982 stripped them of their nationality, making them one of the world's largest stateless communities. While there have been waves of exodus to Bangladesh since the 1970s, none was as rapid and massive as the one in August 2017 that turned the spotlight on the Rohingya crisis around the world. Today, Bangladesh alone is home to nearly a million Rohingya refugees. At least half of those who arrived in the country were children. The UN says the migration was unprecedented in terms of volume and speed. These people know that they cannot stay in Cox's Bazar forever, but it seems that they are not wanted anywhere in this world.
Well, they're not really stateless in reality. They have a right to be its citizens of Myanmar. They've been denied that basic fundamental right. It's not the fact that, by history, they are stateless. Their citizenship has been denied, and you're absolutely right. That is the heart of the problem. And it will not be resolved unless the international community force the Myanmar government to rise up and accept their responsibility for looking after their own citizens.
There were talks of the Rohingya repatriation for the past couple of years, but to this day, nothing has happened. The main reason is that Myanmar's government was always unwilling to accept the refugees. Bangladesh has time and again pushed hard to begin the repatriation, but Myanmar has been delaying it, saying that it needs more time for logistical arrangements. The Rohingya Muslims also fear for their safety in case they return to their country. A UN fact-finding mission in Myanmar says that approximately 600,000 Rohingya are still inside the country, living under the threat of genocide. The world body says no refugees will agree to be repatriated without assurance of full citizenship, ethnic rights, to settle back in Myanmar. Given the Myanmar's leaders' reluctance to address the issue, the minority group's fate is a major cause for concern that is only being voiced by a select group of countries around the world.
The brawl between amateur investors and Wall Street professionals began with hedge funds and big corporations shortening the stock or betting on several small companies' fall of share prices. That captivated people's attention on social media, and in the wake of it, online campaigns led to the buying of the company's stock with aim of pushing up the price. Companies like GameStop were shorted by hedge funds and were labeled as failing by big investors. However, the online movement dramatically soared prices with its stock, trading between $112 and $480 a share. That's up from around $18 a share a few weeks ago. That's while some investors were also hoping to make a quick buck, and others seeking to squeeze the hedge funds. The movement cost hedge funds and other big investors dearly, causing investment platforms such as Robinhood to put a ban on trading stock for GameStop, AMC, BlackBerry Limited, the Nokia Corporation, and several other companies, which resulted in shares to fall by 50%. This ignited protests outside the company's California headquarters and in the Manhattan banking district yesterday. Also, groups of angry protesters gathered in front of New York's Stock Exchange and chanted, "I want my money, and I want it now." They were also holding up signs which read, "Tax Wall Street and tax the rich." The act of restricting stock trade sparked lawsuits and called for investigations from lawmakers. Consequently, the Robinhood's co-founder, Vlad Tenev, announced that the suspension of trading of the stocks will be lifted, though only a limited amount of shares could be traded under the company's supervision. He also rejected the notion that this act is in favor of the hedge funds. The war between amateur investors and Wall Street has caused mayhem in the US stock market, with professional investors calling stock movements being obviously disconnected from fundamentals. However, how powerful are the big corporations, and can they restrict investors from buying shares and stopping individuals gaining a slice of the cake?
I think what we're seeing is people are extremely frustrated because a subgroup of people on Reddit have been able to game the system of Wall Street in their favor against billion-dollar hedge fund managers, and they're finally seeing a clamoring for regulation all of a sudden on Wall Street now that it's the people at the top that are being affected. For decades, for centuries, the Wall Street fat cats have been able to profit off the misery of others. They've made billions, trillions of dollars. They've gotten bailouts. They've done speculative measures. They've profited off of the misery of others, and yet nothing has happened.
Regulators in the United States have warned that the situation is under their scrutiny following a number of share trading platform suspension of trade stocks of the GameStop company and several other firms. One of these share trading platforms is Robinhood, a company that's been accused of gamifying share trades. Robinhood is also under fire for its decision to suspend trading and has sparked outrage among investors who accuse the firm of working in favor of hedge funds and big Wall Street investors who are losing millions of dollars to an army of novice traders. The anger has now spread beyond the investment community, with U.S. politicians joining the backlash against Wall Street. Democratic Representative Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez has called the restriction unacceptable, calling for more details to be published on Robinhood's decision. She also criticized suspending retail investors from purchasing stocks, while hedge funds are free to trade as they wished.
People are upset. People are upset that they have been able to outsmart those on Wall Street and turn a bigger profit for themselves. Some people were able to turn $30,000 into $1 million, etc. They want to continue to be able to do that, and they see this as an attack on the free market. Obviously, the market has never been free, and it continues to be a game that's completely rigged. But I think the defining point is the fact that finally the free market was able somehow to be used to help those who are more at the bottom than more at the top, and obviously you have the free market intervening to prevent this from happening further.
It seems that the online mania to steal from the rich and give to the poor has been betrayed by Robin Hood, who seems to be the real sheriff of Nottingham in this case. However, the fury against control of the system of big corporations and hedge funds has left people with no choice but to unite. But could the army of novice investors win a battle against the Goliath of big corporations and hunt down the real wolves of Wall Street?
Minutes. founded in 1949, UNRWA meant to support Palestinian refugees dispersed across the region after the creation of the Israeli regime with jobs, essential food, health care, and education. The bombshell to eliminate the agency was dropped by the French daily Le Monde in last December. According to the daily, the Israeli and Emirati officials have formulated a strategic axis to make UNRWA progressively disappear, without conditioning this on any resolution of the Palestinian refugee problem. The fact is, the Israeli Prime Minister has long been complaining about the existence of UNRWA, blaming it for perpetuating the narrative of the right to return, which the Israeli regime regards as an existential threat. Through various ways, including expansion of settlements, the regime has tried to Judaize the entire occupied territories, and therefore the existence of millions of Palestinian refugees in neighboring countries would make the Judaization project difficult.
For the past 23 years, the Israeli narrative has been threatened by the mere survival of Palestinians, and all policies that Israel is employing to silence and to marginalize Palestinians, from apartheid policies to ongoing settler colonialism, dispossession, house demolitions, jailings, and killings of Palestinians, including children, is part of a ongoing Nakba that is very genocidal in its structure. And Israel's policies are a form of the settler colonial inscription that demands an erasure of the indigenous people. Now, the UNRWA is a reminder of Palestinians and their refugee crisis that Israel has created during its violent wars and expulsion of Palestinians in 1948.
With the abolition of UNRWA, millions of Palestinian refugees concentrated in camps across Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, the West Bank, and Gaza will become displaced people scattered around the world, and their right to return will automatically vanish. In Gaza, refugees have been under the Israeli regime's crippling siege for 13 years, while almost all Palestinian refugees in Syria are living in extreme poverty as a result of the war. And in Lebanon, they need sustained humanitarian assistance.
This is a rather threatening development for Palestinians, because the UNRWA does assist millions of Palestinians in their daily lives and also employs thousands of Palestinians. Now, this latest move is not surprising, given that Israel has been trying to silence Palestinians and their narrative for decades. And it is also part and parcel of Israel's transnational violence, as it has for the past 73 years tried not only to silence and basically erase Palestinians within Palestine, but also across its borders in refugee camps all over the region.
The first blow to UNRWA was dealt when former U.S. President Donald Trump ended its annual funding to the agency. In last November, Filippo Lazzarini, UNRWA's Commissioner General, raised the alarm that his agency was on the edge of a cliff. In a series of tweets, he wrote that the donations to UNRWA had been the lowest since 2012. Contributions in 2020 to UNRWA core education, health, and relief services are lowest since 2012, while needs of Palestinian refugees have significantly increased. This situation today, the worst financial crisis of the agency's recent history. Having the UAE on its side is clearly a crucial step for the Israeli regime to fulfill its dream of greater Israel. In the words of French journalist Benjamin Barth, in doing so, Abu Dhabi would be rallying to a long-standing demand from Israel, which insists that the agency is obstructing peace by nurturing refugees in the dream of returning to the lands from which their parents were driven in 1948.
Israel wants the refugee problem to be solved by the Arab states, at the expense of the Arab states, and in the location of the Arab states. And of course, this is against UNRWA's mandate, and it's against the wishes of the Palestinian people who want to return to their homes. So nobody has ever seriously considered Israel's request to extinguish UNRWA. And the United Arab Emirates says, well, maybe we can give you something new. Maybe we can offer you something that nobody really wants other than you, which is to pretend that the Palestinian people don't exist.
While Abu Dhabi has remained silent about the allegation leveled by Le Monde, there are a number of reasons to suspect its collusion with Tel Aviv. Although the UAE was a major funder of UNRWA in 2018 and 2019, Abu Dhabi cut its $52 million in 2019 to $1 million in 2020.
I mean, the Emirati regime is in an axis together with the Israeli regime and the United States, and it has, ever since the normalization, extended its economic ties with the Zionist regime, but it also aims to extend its access to the Mediterranean through Israel through its economic and political collaboration, and it has standardized Zionism to an extent. Now, at the same time, the United Arab Emirates cannot speak on behalf of Palestinians, nor any other regime, particularly given that the UAE regime does not even have a democratic mandate from its own population.
By doing such a big favor to the occupying regime, Emirati officials expect a closer military integration with Israel. For example, the UAE has long tried to acquire Israel's Iron Dome missile interception system, and now it hopes to get the system in the near future. The question of the transfer of this technology will be raised in coming years. In fact, by betraying the Palestinian cause, the Emiratis hope to get access to arms and intelligence from the UAE, and Israel refrained from them under the doctrine of ensuring the regime's regional qualitative military edge.
The Palestinians have always suffered in the Arab world, Arab leaders anyway, supporting them verbally without actually doing anything to help them. Pretending to be on our side without actually advancing our interests. Talking about using our cause to justify repressing their own people because we are very busy fighting the Israelis.
All in all, a continued denial of funding might eventually result in the abolition of UNRWA and a further displacement of Palestinian refugees. It's hard to believe that an Arab country is helping the Israeli regime erase the Palestinian refugees from history. The issue is still underreported, but it doesn't mean that the opposite is at play.
IRIB English Radio.